Welcome to the Journalism Explainer podcast, a new podcast series produced for Australia's Fairfax Media. I'm Julie Pizzetti and I'll be collaborating with Singapore-based journalist Asha Phillips to bring you the stories behind the story of journalism's reinvention. First up, we're going to dissect The Big Sleep, an incredibly powerful interactive feature by The Age about the challenging issue of assisted suicide. It was a story that moved audiences to share their own extraordinary stories about death in a manner that sent the piece viral. So what made this story so special? The reporter was health editor of The Age, Julia Medew. The multimedia editor was Felicity Lewis. And the video producer was Tom McKendrick. They've joined me to discuss the story's development and its impact. Can I start with you, Julia? The story is a difficult one. It's a story about emotionally charged content, people's experiences. It's a story that touches on policy and legal issues that are also problematic. Why did you decide to tell it?
It's a good question. We've got a pretty solid history of reporting on this very murky, difficult topic. I've written a few stories about cases involving people who are terminally ill, which is a kind of much simpler story to tell, I guess, and it's less challenging for people to understand why people like that would want to take their own lives. This was something that was a really dramatic leap away from that, these were two people who were elderly, yes, but had decided that they'd lived full lives and didn't want to run the risk of further deterioration in their health, and they certainly didn't want to lose their independence. So to me, that's something that I think a lot of people can probably connect with, and you hear it in your own families that we don't like ageing. So I knew that it was going to be a story that a lot of people would connect with and care about. It was very unusual. There were, you know, two people involved here who had struck an agreement, and we heard that their family, their daughters, were supportive of them. So it seemed to me to have all the right ingredients for a compelling story, and I think my editors and my colleagues agreed.
Just to recap for us the main characters in this story, a husband and wife who were in their 80s. Introduce us to them.
So Pat and Peter Shaw were both aged 87 when they died. They were both scientists. He was a meteorologist. She was a biochemist and someone who lectured in chemistry and the medical faculty at Monash University. They were both incredibly smart people, very rational people, scientifically minded people. They were not religious and they rejected, you know, anyone telling them what to do, basically, and that's the way they'd live their lives. Their three daughters are also very, very smart, independently minded people, and I think that as a family they all agreed that people should live autonomous lives without anyone telling them what to do.
So this is a story where the two main characters have already committed suicide, so they can't speak for themselves. There were three daughters, am I right? And only two of them talked to you on the record, and one ultimately agreed to be filmed. How did you start thinking about how to tell this story? You know, it's obviously a very human story. What were your first thoughts in terms of producing this piece?
Well, we wanted to get as much as we could, and the first step for me was to sit down with Kate Shaw, one of their daughters, who was happy to talk to me about what she was hoping to get out of telling her parents' story. So in some ways I sort of felt like I was being interviewed for the job by Kate, which was fine. It was clearly important for her to establish the ground rules. Then we negotiated to meet her sister Annie, and Annie was happy to talk with me as well, and their third sister was not really wanting to be involved, but she was happy to talk to me off the record too. So I did very extensive interviews with all three daughters, but more extensive with two of them, and it was really important for me to meet with them several times and to talk at great length because, you know, these were three grieving women. Mm. It was pretty fresh when I was talking with them. And, you know, you often find as a journalist that the longer you spend with people, the more you get to know them, the more they trust you, the more willing they are to talk quite openly and honestly. And that was certainly the case with this story. You know, by the time we got to doing a video interview with Annie in their home, she was really quite comfortable with us, and she was talking more openly than our first meeting. And there were some really beautiful details that came out of that meeting, including little tidbits like the fact that their mother, Pat, had left her suicide note tucked into a notebook with their Christmas family pudding recipe. And so those sorts of things which come out while you're sitting around their kitchen bench in their home are the kinds of gems that, you know, really make a story connect with people emotionally, and they're things that almost make it film-like when you tell it, because people can picture the daughters finding this book, seeing the recipe in her scrawled hand. And
I got a visual, just as you were saying that, and kind of imagining the pudding, and also, you know, that they were cooking with love after seeing that letter. So this is a story that 5 or 10 years ago you probably would have written with a weekend magazine in mind, or a features section of The Age. Now, given that we have at Fairfax Media an experienced and talented team of multimedia producers, some of whom, and video producers, some of whom are embedded in our newsrooms, how did you then go about treating this story as a digital story rather than just as a essentially one-dimensional text-based story?
Funnily enough, I had been speaking with our multimedia editor, Felicity Lewis, about her desire to work with me on one of these stories, because I'd written a few of them in the past, so she was quite keen to work with me on it. And so from the very beginning of this process, you know, I had a meeting with a lot of different editors at The Age, and we all came together to try and create a wish list of what we would want out of this, what would make it sing across all these different platforms, and particularly as a multimedia story. And then I was sort of going and trying to get all of the different bits and pieces that we needed from the family to satisfy their needs.
So Felicity, can I bring you in now? What were your first thoughts about how to tell this really challenging story?
Well, it was obviously going to be a very compelling story, but of course to make it a multimedia story you need other media. So I guess I was speaking to Julia a lot about what the visual components of the story might be. And that was another thing that we had to deal with really sensitively as well, that Julia was going back to the Shore Girls and asking whether there are any family photos. And then, of course, you mentioned before, Julia, about the fact that the Shores couldn't speak, but they did write these notes at the very least.
Yes.
And, of course, they had these fabulous records of their lives together, which were visual. It was a visual record. And so, fortunately, the girls were generous in providing us with lots and lots of material that we could then choose from in putting the piece together.
One thing that I came away with was it was actually a great lesson in not trying to influence events before the fact. So in discussing it with Julia beforehand, I knew the things that stood out were obvious. There were certain elements of the story which had a certain movement to them, a certain visual element to them. When we got there and in negotiation with Annie, it was quite clear that a lot of those things we decided we wouldn't represent on camera or in words.
What sorts of things were they?
I suppose there were things that the family didn't want included in the story, and there were a lot of them happened to fall into the basket of things which would have been very visual. So at the end of the actual interview, that it was a very strong and very emotional experience. It went for quite a long time in terms of what you would normally expect. My producer head said, "I'm not quite sure how this is going to come together. I'm not quite sure what I've got." As soon as I gave it a few days, sat down, spent a lot of time just looking through it, and as soon as I sort of reacquainted myself with Annie and with the story, it was almost the classic of what you would normally not do in a straight up and down video, which was just a talking head. And it really had to be as unmediated as possible.
And do you think, looking back at that now, it worked and it was the best thing you could have done, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. Yes, yeah. I think the comment that you get very close to you've met the person, you get very close to the edit. The comments from those who came to it fresh were colleagues. The first reaction was really, despite the separation of 6 to 8 weeks since it had happened, she was still clearly very traumatised. And we treated her as carefully and as respectfully as we could, but the emotions were still very much at the surface, as you'd expect. But that came across, and to add she actually made a very funny comment where we're going to attempt to take a visual technique where we get some of the old photo albums and have a bit of sunlight shining across them. And I said to her, I negotiated that with her, I said, can we try that? She said, she's very straight as a person normally, and she said, all right, you can, don't make it look corny. And that actually really resonated in the edit as well, because I stripped everything back. There was no music, there was very little overlay, it was just her.
And I guess, you know, often we're tempted as journalists and audiences are conditioned to expect things like reenactments. Mm. And clearly that was going to be difficult ethical territory when you're dealing with suicide. So is that something that you were also mindful of?
Yeah, we actually discussed this a little bit because one of the most dramatic parts of the story, of course, was when Peter sat with his wife and she took her own life, and the arrangement was that he would be with her at that time and then he would take his life afterwards. And there was this very powerful part of the story where he actually walked from their bedroom where he left her, wrote a note to his daughters to say that it had gone as well as it could have been expected to have gone, and that he was then going to move on and take his own life. And just the thought of him walking the length of the house, writing that note, and then going to the shed where he took his own life, you know, was really kind of heartbreaking. And the daughters also spoke about how much they feared something going wrong there. Because, of course, if he wasn't successful or he fell or something happened, then he could have been accused of killing his wife or assisting her suicide. And we did discuss whether or not we could film a little bit of the house just to give people a picture of the scene. And, but the family understandably said that that was just a bit too far for them. So we absolutely respected that.
This is almost a story. The backstory is a story of meeting obstacles and overcoming them, isn't it? And doing things that are conventionally considered not to be the savviest thing to do when it comes to producing multimedia content, but it's worked. Just back to the method, Felicity Lewis, that you adopted for this, you used a platform that Fairfax has signed up to, which is called Shorthand, which essentially makes the process pretty streamlined. I mean, understand that we do a lot of, here at Fairfax, a lot of bespoke multimedia as well, but this is a situation where you chose to use a pre-existing platform to tell the story. Why did you decide to do that, and you know, what was the effect in terms of visual narratives?
Well, I suppose it was the phrase less is more kept coming to my head during the previous discussion, and fortunately in this situation I think this was one of those stories where the story itself was the narrative was so strong, and it was beautifully written. And really, we didn't need a whole lot of other bells and whistles. So Shorthand's something that we've customised with little quirks for ourselves. And it just seemed that with the material that we finally ended up with, Shorthand seemed like the perfect way to go, because we were able to start with the big photo of the Shores. We were able to end with a very different kind of photo of their last day together, and there was room for video, so there was really room for all the ingredients that we had. We could have even put in more little flourishes, I suppose you'd say, but the only thing we did was that the art director on the project, Mark Stieler, found a texture to put in the background, which was like the linen on a family photo album. It's very subtle, that kind of thing. It was just a bit of texture. And then the only other decisions that we had to make were, you know, the arrangement of photos and what photos would be full screen and what would look more like family snaps.
And it is, I mean, just for people who are listening and haven't got access to the vision at the moment, but it's it is a simple platform. It is a lot like flicking through a photo album, isn't it? Like the picture slides up and down, and, you know, you get a sense of the kind of experience. I mean, the text was lyrical, was beautiful, but it was simply done too.
I think it's, in a way, that helped people connect to it, because it was quite an intimate kind of domestic family story, and I think people really warmed to the family photo album feel of it.
Well, let's talk about the way it was received, the impact of the story, and start with the audience reaction. Julia, I think in talking to you, or it might have been in reading a piece you wrote about the process, you mentioned that the piece was sent live, and you sat back and wondered, and it looked like there was a little bit of interest, and by the time you revisited, you know, Facebook, I think you're talking about, it looked like it had gotten, you know, very good traction. What was that process like, watching the interest build in the story, and what kind of conversations did you guys monitor?
Yeah, look, it was really amazing to watch it being shared and sort of proliferating all weekend, you know. And so not only could we actually see that for ourselves on The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald and our various Facebook pages and Twitter profiles, but, you know, I was just getting flooded with phone calls and text messages and emails from people that were really, you know, quite heartfelt. And some people were telling really personal stories about their own families, about their own parents, talking about doing this sort of thing. It just hit a nerve, and, you know, it showed us that our instincts were correct, that this was a story that people were going to care about. And, yeah, it was really quite satisfying, actually, because we felt like, I think all of us felt like we'd served the family really well, and that's always a good feeling. But we also felt like we were really kind of doing our job as journalists and as a media company, you know, that we were telling a story that really mattered.
That was important. And, I mean, it's the sort of story I can imagine, you know, hearing some digital editors responding to with concern. You know, how am I going to sell a story to an audience about a double suicide, about death? That was clearly overcome, and it was propelled through its shareability, wasn't it? It was, you know, watching people's interaction with it, whether it be on Facebook or Twitter, or the calls and the messages. So can I ask you, Felicity, what you took away from that in terms of audience engagement, what you learned from people's responses?
I think that from this story and from a couple of others that we've done, I think people are really grappling with things like death, life and death in their lives. Mm. Like that's where they live. That's what people are dealing with, illness and aging. And so I think that kind of those kind of stories are really important for people. And as Julia said in the comments section, people had their own stories to tell, and there were so many of them. And I suppose just in that sense that it reaffirmed that sometimes, you know, the powerful story doesn't need a whole lot of fancy stuff to be told. You know, that was the kind of takeout from a multimedia perspective.
What sort of numbers did you end up with in terms of people reading the piece and sharing it?
Well, on Fairfax around the country, there were 1.1 million people had read it.
What about the print component of this story? So you finished this multimedia piece, it was ready to go. You then had to reverse publish it to print. This is an organisation, Fairfax Media, where we are online, we have websites, we have social media assets, we also have printed newspapers. And The Age obviously wanted to carry this story. What did this storytelling process tell you about the ongoing role of print in storytelling?
Well, it was certainly a factor in when we chose to run it, but it was also it was interesting because the importance of our interaction with the family was obviously central to it, especially Julia's. They were all dead set that it had to run on in the Saturday newspaper. For their family, that was a really, really important part of, and almost a part of the negotiations of the story in the first place. And Peter Shaw had written a letter to the editor 5 or 10 years ago on this issue, and that played into their minds as well. It was also interesting that they're both very active people, and they had, right into their later years, had refused to ever have the newspaper delivered to their house because they both wanted to ride a bike to the newsagents to buy a copy of the paper.
The family, the three daughters, felt that the audience, probably, possibly most interested in this story, were people of their parents' age, and including their friends and family. So they felt very strongly about it being published in the paper, and they felt that the Saturday paper was the right space for it, and you know, a very high-selling paper still. So we did have to work out the timing, because clearly when you're dealing with multimedia presentations and the websites, there are peak times for running stories. And we knew that this was a really good story, and we wanted to kind of launch it at the right time. So there was a lot of in-house conversation around balancing the plan to run it in the Saturday paper with the right time to run it online. So we ended up putting it up online at around noon on the Friday, and then it ran in the paper on the Saturday. And, you know, it worked really well.
And it went global too, didn't it? I mean, this is not a story that stopped at the Australian borders. As I understand it, it's been picked up for syndication.
Yeah, we've been inundated with requests for syndication in publications through mainly throughout Europe. And it was interesting, in the days afterwards, there were lots of journalists from overseas media organisations trying to get through to the Shaw family to try and talk to them. They didn't want to do media at that stage, so I was sort of fielding all of these requests and passing them on. But, yeah, I mean, it suggests that this is not just a local issue by any means.
Indeed, it's a human experience, which is international,
Yeah.
In terms of policy impact, were there political reactions? What about the medical fraternity? What kinds of responses did you get, and how did you deal with those in terms of follow-up stories?
Yeah, there was quite a positive reaction from doctors, actually. There were a lot of doctors who got in touch with me sort of privately to say, you know, good stuff, you need to keep writing about this issue. But the medical profession is very conservative, and they are really finding this difficult to deal with. I think the AMA is actually going to be discussing it amongst its membership this year at a meeting, because they just don't know how to respond to it publicly. They've got a diverse membership, and doctors, you know, save lives. They're not really wanting to get into the business of assisting people to die, but increasingly they're being asked to. So it's a difficult one for them. Politically, it's funny, some politicians got in touch with me to thank me for the story, again privately. They have to toe their party lines on this issue. This is not someone who's terminally ill. This was, you know, an elderly couple. So for politicians who are sort of dealing with the first step of trying to get up consultation on, you know, assisted dying laws, they're not going to be looking at people like the Shaws and allowing elderly people to be assisted to die when they're not terminally ill. That is just not going to be the first step. So it's an awkward one for them. But nonetheless, it is factoring into a Victorian parliamentary inquiry that's looking into end-of-life choices. And the Shaw family has made a submission. That's all underway, that the politicians involved in that inquiry are looking at it, and they'll be responding by May.
Which is all the purpose of journalism stuff, isn't it? It's not just about telling a story. It's about hopefully having an impact on policy through sharing people's stories, especially when it comes to health, for example. What about the comments, though, that people left? You said people were sharing their own stories. Did you find that the comments and the social media interaction generated additional stories that you're now pursuing?
Yeah, well, it did for me, yeah. So, yeah, quite a few stories, and it's difficult because you don't sort of, as a reporter that covers the health beat, you know, which is really diverse and rich and mixed, it's difficult just to throw all of your time at this one issue. Mm. So I'm just gradually getting back to people who have got in touch with me, and I think slowly we'll roll out the stories that should be told. But yeah, I think it'll be a gradual process.
One of the comments that I saw, which I think you actually referenced, Julia, in your reporting of the aftermath, was somebody who had read the piece who was depressed, suggesting that this piece may actually have had a contagion effect in terms of driving people to commit suicide. That's a pretty tough bit of feedback to take, and I know that you went really responsibly down the path of including contact information on the piece for support lines for, you know, mental illness and suicide. But how do you respond to that? Did you respond to it?
Yeah, I did. So I actually got a few people coming to me with that concern. And, you know, it's a really difficult one because the media has traditionally shied away from reporting on suicide because of that fear. But in recent years, that's really started to change. And there's a feeling that talking about it is actually more beneficial than harmful. Mm. So I think it's kind of telling in some ways that of thousands and thousands of comments, we only got a handful of people, you know, raising a red flag to that effect. And, you know, it's difficult. It is difficult feedback to take, and we'll never know if it's affected some people, you know, in a bad way. But, you know, I think that this is something that people want to talk about. It's going to be talked about, and I think we just have to do it as responsibly as we can.
Mm. So, Tom, let's go back to video for a moment. We know that audiences are hungry for video, particularly where they have good access and capacity to stream or download. But we know also that there's a really a great hunger among news producers to incorporate video. What did you learn from this piece in terms of the kind of filming that you did and the way the video was produced that you'll take forward?
I think the point earlier about the stripping it down to its essentials, I think maybe as a more overarching lesson, it was a great guide as to fitting the content to the story, if you like. Content to story, if you like.
Yes.
Slightly clunky term, but it clearly needed something simple, something quite, from a filmmaking point of view, pretty traditional. It was probably six shots other than the interview. They were all shot nicely but simply. They served a purpose. Beyond that, there was no real artifice to it, if you like, in the edit. We move away from kind of TV principles quite significantly now, using graphics and text and removing things like voiceovers, etc. But this demonstrates that those sort of techniques are there and have been established for a reason, and that you still need to know how to use them effectively.
And that can be really effective storytelling devices.
Yeah.
What about you, Felicity, in terms of the multimedia production side of this? What did you take away?
I suppose just the way that a lot of those photos of the shores were so fantastic in their own right, but there's something about the way that they're put together when they sit together, and when they sit together alongside this narrative, they just develop a kind of resonance of their own. So you look at the opening photo and it's got this not sweet romance, but a kind of, this is an adventurous life these people are going to have. There's an innocence about it. And then they proceed to have this fabulously adventurous life. And then we move through that visually, and then we have that photo at the end. And then if you go back up to the top after you've read the whole story and look at that photo again, it just has this poignancy to it.
Yeah, there's a human timeline to it as well.
Sure.
So it ends, like the image that it ends on, which is an elderly couple on the day that they chose to die. Mm. Julia, what about you? What were the key lessons as the journalist, reporting this story for you?
I guess, to take it slow. I mean, I really did spend a lot of time with those three sisters, and I'm really grateful that I did that because, as I said, you kind of get some really great things towards the end, just when you're sitting around having a cup of tea and you think it's all done. So that was a good lesson. The other interesting thing that happened for me with this is I decided to write it differently to how I would usually approach the writing. And I sat down with one of our fantastic writers and editors here, Kate Cole Adams, and said to her, I've got this really terrific story and I just want to talk it out and figure out how I'm going to tackle this. Because I had, 8-10 hours of interviews, on my dictaphone, and usually I'd sit there and try and transcribe them, over days and really mull over everything that they've said to me and think, how on earth am I going to get all of this into a 2,500-word story? And it was great because I sat there and the first thing I said to Kate over a coffee was, for as long as these girls can remember, their parents were talking about taking their lives one day. And she said, bang, that's where you start it. I mean, you've just told me the story. This is how you would tell your friend. This is how you'd sit down and talk to anyone about it. So it was really me just conversing with the reader in the way anyone would tell that story. And, it was written very tightly, and with the assistance of Kate. Kate did some great editing for me where she just kind of cut a few things back and we made it really simply written. That a lot of people would be tempted to kind of dress it up and get all writerly with it, but it was told really simply, and I think that went well. I think it served them well.
And, we can get caught up thinking about the power of the whiz-bangery, the sexy elements of multimedia, but the story sort of began and ended, didn't it, with the writing craft. And yes, it was conversational, and, it was very personal, and there was an intimacy about the style of the writing, which I think worked really nicely, that drew people in, but all of those elements working together. I'm just wondering if there's anything you would do differently if you were to come at this story again.
I don't think so from my perspective. I mean, it really did shape up well, I got everyone involved very early in the piece, and I think that was the right thing to do. And I think we're all feeling now like it just worked out really well. For that reason, there was a huge amount of consultation and collaboration. And, people like Kate Cole Adams as well involved. which made it as good as I think we could.
I think there's is it like any story, you have all these things that you leave on the floor, and all these. I think I certainly thought about these different ways that parts of the story, fascinating elements of the story, which you could look at their approach, their atheism, if you like, or their the impact it had on the grandchildren as and how that make they take it through life, and all these other things that could have formed a fascinating story in themselves, but it was very clear. And I think what you said earlier, an editor told me many years ago, he said, you think about a story as if you're telling a joke to a friend in a pub, and it's not to make light of it, but it's just to what actually matters most about the story. And you kind of do that. You may go home and tell your partner, just found the story, and they'll say, oh yeah, wow. And their reaction is exactly that. It was these two people. All these other things are fascinating, but it's the reaction of the person that you take from
it. Okay, I think we'll leave it there. So, Julian Mathieu, Felicity Lewis, and Tom McKendrick, thanks very much for joining the Journalism Explainer.
Thank you.
Thank you.